Om Shanti. Today the subject is the volcanic stage of yoga, or the practice of being a volcano. So there is a negative sense of a volcano in the sense of someone who explodes with rage. That also is described as a volcanic type of person. And Baba had told us that giving up anger, which is giving up that kind of volcanic behavior, is connected with giving up the two negative senses of I. You may remember there was Murli about 10 days back, perhaps, in which Baba mentioned very interestingly that the alloy of impurity enters the soul via the fire of lust. And so in the Murli also, from time to time, the funeral pyre of lust and the funeral pyre of jnana are contrasted with each other. And so we're talking about fire as the element that brings in negativity as well as the element that removes the negativity. So we're talking about purification by fire. And there is the analogy from the Ramayana of Sita, who had to go through the test of fire. Are you familiar with this story? No? So I'll just briefly mention it, and that'll be a reminder for those who know. You know that the story of the Ramayana involves a section in which Sita and Rama had been sent in banishment away from the kingdom. So they had to live in the forest. And then Ravan had his eye on Sita. And so he found a way to get Ram out of the way by pretending to be a golden deer. And Lakshman, the brother of Ram, had placed a circle called the Line of Maryada around Sita, saying, stay within this line and then nothing will happen to you, because Ram had left him to look after Sita while he went off to get the golden deer, and then she sent him off to go and find Ram, who hadn't returned. So the way in which she could be protected is by staying within these lines of Maryada. And then she put her hand out beyond the line, because Ravan appeared to her in the form of a Brahman. So looks good, or you can say a wolf in sheep's clothing. Looks good but wasn't the real thing. So you have to be very, very aware about what looks good but isn't actually the real thing. So as soon as she put her hand out of the line of Maryada to give him a donation, and so he guilt-tripped her into giving a donation, and then he carried her off and put her in the cottage of sorrow known as Shokavatika. So she had to be then rescued by Ram with the help of Hanuman. So it's a long, long story. I won't tell you all those details. But the thing is, once you have been kidnapped by somebody, the enemy, then the question of your purity is under scrutiny. Because normally what happens if a woman gets stolen by some other man, she's liable to be raped. And then, of course, she's not pure anymore. So Sita didn't even look at Ravan, so her purity remained intact. But just the fact that she had got stolen required her to pass through a test of fire so that it could be seen that she was actually pure. Because if you can survive going through the test of fire, then it means you're pure. And it's rather like the story of Joan of Arc. You may be familiar with the story of Joan of Arc? Yes? No? Who knows the story? Oh, not very many of you. Well, anyway, Joan of Arc was a French military commander come peasant girl who dressed up as a male to lead the army against the English. And she felt that God had asked her to do this. And the people were afraid of her because she had this power of purity, and she identified herself as La Pucelle, that is, the virgin. And so the most important thing that had to be done was to remove her virginity, because they're afraid of the power of virginity. But anyway, she also got burned at the stake, and the story goes that no matter what raping had been done to her while in prison, her heart was pure. And so she was turned by the Catholic Church into a saint because though she did get burnt at the stake, it became very evident that she was pure. So this goes through most religious or most superstitions, that fire cannot damage a person who is pure. And we even have another little story about that, of the kittens being protected even whilst being in the big fire. This is an Indian story. And then there's even another story of Prehlad, who was the little son of Hiranyakashipu, who was the equivalent of the Christian King Herod, who wanted to make it known that he was the greatest, and then he had to be worshipped as God. And Prehlad refused to worship him as God, and so he tried different ways to destroy him. And that included putting him into the fire. But the fire couldn't burn him because he was pure. So this is the sort of different kinds of stories that exist in different mythologies and different cultures, all of which say the same thing, that fire can only destroy that which is impure. So there is this expression, Agni Yoga, the fire yoga. And there are even some practices in the path of bhakti where the people walk through fire and so on. And you may have seen the fire walkers. So anyway, the kind of fire that we're talking about here has to do with the fire of yoga, which is the intense and extreme love for Baba, which is functioning at the highest possible intensity. So the degree of burning, the highest temperature of burning, is the temperature of a volcano, which can melt granite. So you see in Mount Abu we have all these mountains with boulders strewn around the place. And this, you can just put down the level of your radio if you don't mind. So if you can create such a level of yoga that it can burn even the rockiest of sanskaras, then that kind of purging, that kind of purification by fire is going to succeed. There's also a story of the Western mythology of Hercules. Everybody familiar with Hercules? Yes, you know the stories of the 12 labors of Hercules? Anyway, the last of his 12 labors, these are all capable of being interpreted in a spiritual way and very interestingly. But the last one was to destroy the many-headed hydra, which is a snake with a lot of different heads. So you can see that it must be fairly similar to the 10-headed raven. So what happened when he took his sword to cut off the heads of this many-headed hydra, two would come in its place. So it was not successful. And the only way in which he could destroy this many-headed hydra was to have a torch in one hand and a sword in the other. So he would cut the head with the sword and then sear it with the torch, and then it wouldn't come back again. So this is a very good analogy for what Baba is asking us to do, because if you try to use force, your willpower, to suppress any particular negative sanskara, not only will it not succeed, but the resistance that you will face from that negative sanskara will be doubled. And so instead of destroying it, your struggle with it will become intensified, and so it's not successful. So there has to be the combination of firm determination, which Baba mentioned in the a section of this last Murli, particularly to when he was speaking to the double foreigners. So determination is a very important decision that one has to make, that this is what I will do, no matter what. And so bring into play your inner power and then burn it with the love of Baba, the intensity of that love. So let us look at what a volcano is, because Baba has given us this analogy. So I don't know if any of you have seen a volcano. There are from time to time volcanoes that explode, and especially the most active ones might be easily found in the big island of Hawaii. And now, when a volcano blows, say it blows the top of the mountain off, there's a lot of explosion, a lot of noise, a lot of earthquakes, a lot of dust. And then if it's strong enough, the magma will begin to flow. So the magma is actually from the inner depths of the earth, because you know that the core of the earth is fire. And it's not like a kind of orange with a sort of nice smooth skin, which is what we are standing and walking around on, and then little inside circles, but it's sort of fingers of fire, that some of them are very close to the surface and some of them are further away, and then you have the tectonic plates which are also there. So especially Hawaii is a place which is highly active in terms of volcanoes. And they come actually out from the bottom of the ocean, straight up as islands. So you're just seeing actually the tip of the volcano above the ocean. Some of them are higher than Mount Everest, so very big seamounts. And so when the magma flows, it melts everything in its path. And it goes not necessarily very fast. But suppose it's going through a forest, you know, as it approaches the trees, they just get absolutely burnt up in a second. It is so hot. I don't know offhand the temperature of magma, but very, very hot, several thousand degrees centigrade. So Baba has mentioned over the last two or three years this stage of the volcanic yoga. So it's very intense, it's very hot, it's very dangerous for the force of evil. And so it is quite necessary to understand that if you're going to go for the volcanic stage, you yourself cannot hold on to anything combustible. Otherwise you yourself will be burned. I see. So this is why I think also Baba has been talking about the stage of finishing off not only negative thoughts, but waste thoughts especially. Because if we entertain a waste or a negative thought, then we cannot have volcanic yoga. Because the presence or the existence or the possibility even of waste or negative thoughts prevents that intensity of love and the intensity of the connection between the soul and Baba. Because if you don't have the connection, you cannot generate this kind of heat, this kind of fire that will burn the negativity. So you have a bit of a catch-22 that unless you're completely pure, you can't have that kind of yoga, and you have to have that kind of yoga in order to be completely pure. So, you know, you have to deal with both sides to bring up the heat. So it's a process. And we need to look at another aspect to bring into the, another ingredient to bring into the pot here. And that is a class on volcanic yoga which Dadi Gulzar had given at, I think it was the Kumar's Bhatti in last January, in which she had described volcanic yoga as being yoga which contains all the powers. So it's a very good track to go down. I think it's well worth exploring this particular track for the next part of this class. So have a look in your inner being. Check out the quality and intensity of the presence of the eight powers within yourself. So the eight powers, the power of tolerance, the power of accommodation, the power of discernment or discrimination, the power of judgment, the power of cooperation, the power to face, the power to withdraw, and the power to pack up. I think that's probably all of them, isn't it? And there are other powers that Baba sometimes speaks about, which we need to add to this rosary of powers. One of them is the power of silence. One of them is the power to stop. To stop the thoughts, to stop the feelings, to stop the reactions, the power to hold still, no matter what provocation is there, the power to remain in balance, the power to be detached and beyond, many different powers. So this volcanic yoga can exist when all of those powers exist. So you have almost, it can be looked at as a military situation here. You have all your vices arrayed on one side. It doesn't matter how much work you have done on your character over the years, there's still the presence of something combustible in there, isn't there? A little trace of ego, a little trace of greed, a little trace of arrogance, a little trace of anger, a little trace of lust. All of these things, even in their trace form, they still require to be completely purged from the soul. Because, as Baba said, In the Murli that we just heard on the night of Holi, everybody agreed that we don't want to keep a little bit of the vices. We want to get rid of all of them. Because in the Golden Age, there aren't any vices. And so our work that we're doing here is preparation to carry us there. And if we retain even traces of the vices, then we will not be able to go there. We'll have to go somewhere later on where the alloy has begun to enter the soul. So we'll only be able to arrive at the beginning of the Golden Age if we have removed every last trace of the vices. And that means we are non-combustible. There isn't anything that could have a reaction in the fire. So if you think about the pure gold in the crucible, you know, when that impure gold is put in the crucible and put to the fire, the impurities get burned out, they get spat out, they get destroyed in a variety of ways, and you can see the destruction going on. And when there's no more destruction and the gold is just liquid and pure and clean, then okay, we can dispense with the fire, we can cool it down again, and it will become totally beautiful and soft and deep yellow gold to be prepared. And then you can also look at how diamonds are made. In the natural way, a diamond will occur in coal, because diamond is carbon, isn't it? So diamond is where coal is subjected to intense heat and intense pressure. It will create a diamond. So we ourselves need to be ready and willing and available to be subjected to whatever amount of heat or pressure comes our way, because this is the process which makes us into an imperishable diamond. To all of these analogies that Baba has given us over the years through the Muralis are very relevant as metaphors for what we need to be able to endure. So Baba had also mentioned that you need to have a great deal of power of tolerance, a great deal of power of accommodation, because we need to be able to tolerate and endure the intense heat, the intense pressure, the process of being made into a diamond, or the process of being made into 24 karat pure gold. You see? So this is why these metallurgical sort of industrial processes are mentioned to us, you see. And there are actually very interesting pieces of literature to describe how in primitive times people would make objects that even with today's science can hardly be done, you know, using very, very intense heat and applying it to metals and so on. So generating this heat, having all of the powers within us, it's not something that you can do in one sitting of yoga, naturally. It's really about our entire Brahman life. From the time that we begin Gyan until when we will finish it, that we will say is our entire Brahman life. Whether it's a long time or a short time, but still Baba gives importance to the long time. Because in order to generate this heat, we have to be at it for quite a long time. And Baba has said the time is now finishing. That means to say, it doesn't mean that there's going to be destruction in 5 minutes necessarily. There might be. But what it means is that the available time when nobody much bothers about BKs, is time in which we must use every available moment to stoke up the fire and get this burning process going. And as you have heard from some other Muralis, Baba has said that if your level of fire of yoga is a bit cool, then it's not going to do the job. You see, if you have just an ordinary little fire and you stick a piece of iron in it, it's not going to melt, you know. It's not even going to turn red. And in order to melt, it has to be white hot, you see, otherwise it won't melt. So you probably have the experience of, in the winter time, having a poker in the fire and leaving it there for a while, it will become red hot, but that's not enough, and that's very hot, you see. So if we are cool yogis in that sense, that not very yogi, then all this time is passing, but we think that we're doing yoga, but it's very limited, it's very tepid kind of heat that we're generating. But we want to have nice, pleasant experiences, isn't it? Yes? All the time we should have nice, pleasant experiences. I think that that gives us an excuse to keep our temperature a little low. So therefore, I think we also need to think about maintaining courage to turn up the heat a little bit, or allow the heat to be turned up a little bit. Because our ability to be resilient whilst cooking, I think, is important. Cooking in the sense that, you know, we have bhatis. And in the old Indian scriptures, for example, in the Rig Veda, it talks about cooking the man. But don't overcook him. Make sure that, you know, he's cooked to the right point, you know. And so the bhati means we cook. Cooking means the heat is turned up. And cooking is an expression that refers to transformation, you see. The bhati is not just an oven in which you might cook your dinner as a non-vegetarian, but there's another kind of cooking that goes on, which is the cooking in a kiln. And you know that Baba has often used the analogy of bricks. Huh? You might have seen on the train between Bombay or Delhi and here that you pass the brick making kilns. And you see big piles of bricks and then a big chimney with a lot of smoke coming out of it. Have you seen that? So they make the bricks out of clay, but it's only when they're put in that oven, in that kiln, that they become hard and strong and usable. And so Baba is, in a sense, using all of us as bricks to build the big Brahmin fortress. And so he has to be able to put us in the kiln. And sometimes Baba had said, for all of the people who had been in the bhati of the first 14 years of Gyan, when everyone was in Karachi for 14 years tapasya, that some of the bricks became solid and good and some of them just broke, you see. And when a brick breaks in the kiln, it makes a lot of explosion, and it very often will break other bricks in the process. So we have to also allow ourselves to think of ourselves, okay, I'm a brick and I have to get baked. So I need to allow the heat to be turned up, otherwise I can't be baked. And if I'm not baked, then the first thing I will just fizzle out and fall into dust and clay once again. So I think that in order for us to generate this heat of the volcanic yoga, we have to adjust our relationship with what we think is a proper experience. You see? Because if we want everything to be like a bowl of cherries, it's not going to bake us. You know? So drama has a way of providing us with unpleasant circumstances. Have you noticed? So these are very useful because they're part of the baking process. Yeah? When we have an unpleasant situation, then we have a choice. Yeah? We can either endure it, or we can say it's unendurable. Obviously it's unendurable. But if we have yoga, that means we, you know, use that situation to act as a push, to push us into a greater stage of detachment, push us closer to Baba. That's a way of using it to actually heat up the temperature, isn't it? And very often people say, oh, I'm dying, right? They're not actually dying, but it feels like they're dying. You can be dying for a long time. Yes? Have you felt that? That this is like death, you know. My situation is so awful, I'm just dying. Anybody? I bet you there are. Yes. It's supposed to be like that, because again, this is the circumstances that are provided by Baba and Drama, that are logs or coke for us to actually increase our temperature. You see, coke is like coal, but it burns hotter than coal. So if you want to, if you go to an iron foundry, for example, and you want to melt the iron, or get iron from iron ore, and that's just iron. Here we're talking about rock. But there you have to use coke. So they transform the coal into coke, and then they burn, and they create very high temperatures to melt the iron. So these circumstances, we can look at them as they appear to be and say, this is a horrible circumstance, or we can say, oh, we got some coke. You know, have some coke. And we can use the coke to increase our temperature and burn a bit. So why do we say that a certain circumstance is unbearable, intolerable, it's a death, you know, whatever it is? What kind of circumstances would be that? Somebody doesn't behave the way you want, isn't it? It's usually like that. Someone is insulting me. Someone is restricting me. Someone is ordering me to do something I don't want to do. Isn't it? Something like that? Someone is bothering me. Someone is always, whatever the thing is, shouting at me, forcing me. Something like that, isn't it? And that means to say that you're unable to apply the appropriate power when such a circumstance comes. And then instead of saying to the self, I'm too weak for this, we say, this person is doing the wrong thing. Look, they're a Brahmin and they're behaving like this and it's disturbing me and this is terrible, right? This is what we do, isn't it? Normally? See, so it seems to me to be that. Anyway, so the thing is that we know, we can't change other people, isn't that right? And we've heard so many times we're supposed to change ourselves, and that applies when everything's fine, but then when somebody else is bothering me, then we forget that, oh, I have to change. Why do I have to change? Why do they have to be victorious, and why do I have to melt, you know, and turn into dust or whatever the thing is, you know, because of this other person's bad behavior? It's simply that we haven't understood that Baba and Drama are providing us with some coke. So we have to put it on the fire and sit in that fire and burn a bit so that we can melt, you see. Now for that we have to have a very, very clear understanding about three things. It usually takes us forever to actually get to that point, so I'll tell you them so it doesn't take you so long. And one is, no one can kill you. No one can kill you. You're an immortal soul, right? I hope you remember that one. comes in the first day of the 7 days course. We are souls. We are immortal souls, and the definition of a soul is it cannot be burnt or drowned or cut in half or any of those types of things, which can easily happen to bodies, but they can't happen to souls. So the soul is actually indestructible. So if I'm having an experience that these circumstances are so horrible that I'm about to die, I'm about to get destroyed, it simply means that I am body conscious. And so what I have to become is soul conscious. But you say, well, this is so terrible, I can't possibly become soul conscious, there's no proper circumstances for me to become soul conscious. Circumstances are not going to be proper. We do our spiritual practice actually in circumstances of adversity. And it's supposed to be like that, because if we don't have any adversity, we don't have the proper impetus to actually make the effort to transcend the adversity. Huh? So we need to be able to interpret the thing as it actually is. So very important first thing to make clear to ourselves that I cannot be destroyed. Of course, people, circumstances, the body, the weather, all sorts of things are calculated to give you the impression that you're about to be destroyed by them. So you have to very powerfully affirm and assert that I am an imperishable soul, I am a peaceful soul, thank you very much, you are coke. And so your duty is to burn, and I'm getting purified. So we have to adjust ourselves so that you actually use these apparently awful circumstances to actually melt and free yourself from being susceptible to those things. Of course you need a lot of courage. Of course you need to develop the power of tolerance. But if you have this attitude that, okay, come and disturb me and I will handle it, I will manage it, I will rise to the occasion, I will melt, you know, I am not afraid of those things, then you can actually use these things to your advantage. Otherwise, you become defeated, you see, and you become defeated by being defeatist, you see. The Baba has given the title, you are victorious jewels. And so we're here to handle the attacks of matter and maya and people and circumstances and whatever comes along. It's supposed to bother us, and we are supposed to not be bothered by it. You see? So it's a game only. It's a real game. And so you have to be, you know, on your toes. So this is the first thing. I cannot be killed. Nobody can kill me. You can't destroy me, I'm indestructible. Affirm that, assert that, know that to be true, and whatever is trying to destroy you, let it try, but you just know in advance that it's not possible. However big it seems, it's not actually possible because my definition, I am indestructible, I cannot be killed. Thank you very much. Do your thing and I'll do my thing, like that. Make that attitude. Second is, I cannot be corrupted. You cannot corrupt me. Right? Someone will try to attract you, someone will try to buy you, all these different kinds of things, you see, to corrupt you. So for that, you have to be very close to your truth, you know. Unless we are authentic in every aspect of ourselves, unless we are true in every aspect of ourselves, our conscience will bite. I see. And that's a killer. And most people try to dumb the voice of conscience because it hurts. There's one reason why we don't like meditating, or we fall asleep, or any of those things. You see, we say it's too difficult, can't make it, don't like it, please give me drishti, let's have some music, let's have some good meditation commentaries, whatever the thing is. Those are no substitute for the real thing. So the thing is, if we have a good long meditation, it'll have the effect of bringing these suppressed elements that we have on our conscience that we can't feel, and then it'll bring them to the surface so that we start feeling them. And that burns, you know, because then you have to realize, yeah, I'm guilty of criticizing people relentlessly. I'm guilty of, sticking things and sticking a knife in people's back. I'm guilty of defaming somebody, you know, all these various nice looking things that we do, which are actually wrong, you see, they're on the conscience and they burn when you feel them. And that comes up in yoga, especially 4 a.m., you see, or even more especially 3 a.m. or 2 a.m. So when we have very deep yoga and go into very deep silence, you get a tremendous resistance to your yoga from these things that are on your conscience, any little thing, you know. And so that is also a fire. So we have the fires that are trying to destroy us, and then we have this internal fire which is also trying to destroy us. And we find that we have been not exactly according to our own ethical policy. We haven't exactly conducted ourselves. We've gone against Srimat here and there and the other. We've made a variety of excuses to convince ourselves or justify ourselves that we're okay. But then in deep meditation it comes up as a question, well, is that really okay? And if there's a question, then it means probably isn't, you see. Because if you do a right action, it's clear, and the conscience, it doesn't bother you with it. If you do a wrong action, there's doubt, you see. And there's doubt and guilt and all this kind of thing that comes up. Shows that there are plenty of ways in which you are susceptible to corruption. So you have to affirm and assert your truth and make it clear for yourself that I cannot be corrupted. So you have to actually go deep within yourself and find, okay, what is my ethical policy that I live by? And do not violate that, because if you do, conscience will bite and burn. Third thing is, no one can break my spirit. Right? And there are lots of people who are specially designed to break your ego, right? They all live with you and they're right near and they're all working on breaking your ego, isn't it? You have plenty of those, is that right? Should be. Special trick of drama, that wherever you are, there's going to be a few people who are specially focused on breaking your ego, you know, and it'll feel like they're breaking your spirit. So we have to make this fine distinction between breaking my spirit, that means destroying my soul, which is indestructible, and breaking my ego, which actually needs to melt. The ego is the thing, this me, you know, Baba talked about the three I, me. One I am a soul, I am a dot. I am indestructible, I am incorruptible, I am unbreakable. That I is the I of self-respect and self-awareness, self-recognition. This is the only I that is valid. Then the other I's are the false ego. I am the greatest thing there is. I know everything, much better than anybody else. Or I'm no good, I'm hopeless, I'm a lost cause, you know. So just the flip-flop between those two, this kind of manic depressive sanskaras, These are the two eyes that have to be burned in that volcano. And they are rock hard. They are absolutely convinced of their own invincibility and indestructibility. So the eye of the soul has to win, and the eye of the false ego has to be destroyed. And it's a serious battle in which volcanic yoga is required. It's rather like having a nuclear war between your real self and your substitute for your real self. And so it's a very serious business. It's not just, you know, snakes and ladders or anything like that. So I think one of the things that we do need to consider is sort of upgrading the quality of our relationship with our spiritual practice from a little party game to something a little bit more serious, you see, because otherwise, you know, we have to be, as it were, professional yogis as opposed to sometime amateur yogis, because otherwise we're not going to succeed in the victory that Baba is training us for. So that means I think we have to give it a priority. We have to take it seriously and rethink the priorities in our lives. So it's not that we're a person who does a bit of Raj Yoga on the side, but we're a Raj Yogi who does a bit of other things on the side. You know, change that priority so that our spiritual practice becomes the most important aspect of our lives. And of course, there's a price to be paid. Nothing comes free, you know, Raj Yoga is free, but, you know, it's highly expensive. There isn't anything more expensive than easy free Raj Yoga. Right? Isn't it? Yes, it's easy, but it's not so easy. How are you going to generate that kind of heat? It's not easy. That requires focused attention and over a long period of time. And until and unless we make it the highest priority, well, basically it can't be done. So I hope I'm not sort of discouraging you, is that? Nobody's getting discouraged? No, it's okay? Good. Yeah. So anything that could distract you. Say, for example, you're sitting in the Murli. You know, I don't know how you listen to the Murli, but I listen to it in such a way that I can feel the impact of every word, as well as understand all the different nuances of every word, because there's an intellectual component and there's a heart component also, right? And there's a music that you had to be in the rhythm of. So you had to be actually highly concentrated to listen to the Murli. And then somebody wants to make a comment about two or three points ago to you who's sitting next to you. Isn't it? So if you ignore them, then that's impolite. But if you don't ignore them, you're going to lose out. So you have to see what's the priority. You know, so therefore this, what I call enlightened self-interest is a very important factor in order to enable us to succeed in being experts at this game of the battle between the nuclear power of the soul and the nuclear power of the body consciousness, you see. So we have an agreement, I think, amongst all of us that we are primarily students of Raj Yoga. So when we're sitting in the Murli, with full concentration. One of the reasons why people like to sit up at the front is because at the back they're all talking and they're getting up and they're sleeping and all kinds of horrors going on, so that the atmosphere is very disturbed at the back of the class. So if you're sitting at the front, it's better because there's less upheaval. And so it's generally considered that the better students have a tendency to prefer to sit in the front because they're not comfortable with all of that distraction and people opening their bags and closing their, having cop suites and all of that business. Huh? It goes on, isn't it? You know, so that means you have to have a very strong power of concentration and depth of love for the murali, so that you don't even notice that stuff, you see. Of course, if you can be at the front and away from any kind of problems like that, that's nice. But if you can't, then you have to have extra power of concentration so that those things don't actually pull your attention. So Baba spoke about kinchatar, you know, this pull. I think in the murali it was translated as strain, which is one way to do it, but it's really a pull. Things are pulling on your attention, trying to deviate you away from the focus of your attention. And then these things come not only from outside, but also from inside, because you're listening to the murali and your mind will associate it with something very important, very necessary, very relevant, but you will miss the next 3 points. So again, there's a price to pay, you know. So I have to actually be willing to pay the price of not having my associations, or if I'm going to have them, then I'm going to have to lose out on taking in the murali fully and flawlessly, you see. Because the murali is an injection. Is something that has to go into your soul on a daily basis in its full, undiluted intensity, you know, so that you are sustained, so that you is fuel for your volcano. So you need every little last bit of it. So if you're distracted, or you fall asleep, or you're off in other little associations, then you're going to need to rethink your priorities and give higher priority to the full-on focused murali. I see. And you're going to need to make sure that when you wake up in the morning, you wake up fresh, not exhausted. And so that means that you calculate your waking by your sleeping the previous night. I see. So you know when you have to go to sleep in order to be fresh by 3:30. And so there may be some other distraction. And then you have to see. If you give importance to your meditation, then you have to give up that thing. You see, it may be a party, it may be a movie, it may be whatever. You know, it may be service. Usually service, isn't it? Lots of things which go by the name of service which actually disturb our meditation. And so then we have to calculate and see, you know, is this service because I've decided it's service, or is it really service? Because there's a lot of things in that. So what is service? You know, we have to do service. But I think many of us do service instead of Gyan, Yoga and Dharana. So I think it's also very good for us to identify service as the thing that happens automatically and necessarily as a consequence of Tyag and Tapasya. So Tyag is renunciation, and then Tapasya is the intense meditation. So ours is a life of tapasya, and service will happen. So let's try a few minutes of volcanic yoga. See if you can be totally concentrated on that point with intense love. So tyag and tapasya have to be the higher priorities. It has to be in that order of a hierarchy. Tyag first, then tapasya, then service. Tyag, renunciation, means absolute simplification of your life. Anything additional, any fluff, any embroidery, make your life lean and clean and simple, like a Japanese dining room. You know how it is? Have you seen? Very, very simple. Whatever is absolutely necessary is there. Anything else we don't need. Clutter. Take out all the clutter. And then these desires, they also constitute a production of all sorts of garbage, of clutter. And so tyag has to be tyag of anything that you use to bolster your self-esteem, because it means that that's all part of the ego and it doesn't actually have anything to do with self-esteem. So again, in terms of your sense of self, stripped down to the barest bones of the titles that Baba gives us, you know, I am a victorious jewel, so I'm not bothered by any problems. Any. I am a victorious jewel, I can handle anything, whatever comes. Yeah, I'm a dot. Simple. Go for your five original qualities. Peace, love, purity, power, bliss. Even happiness is peripheral, you know. Bliss. There's nothing to do with anything external. Happiness is different from bliss in that happiness is a result of something. You know, you do some good service, you get some happiness. You know, somebody's nice to you, you get some happiness. Somebody gives you name and praise and glory and all that, and you get a little bit of happiness. So there's temporary happiness. But bliss, you know, I exist in a state of bliss. Nothing to do with anything that's going on or not going on. That is an original form, you see. So these five elements of the soul, they are very, very good to have. That's your total existence, and it is like a five-petaled flower that's just focused on Baba. And that's it, you know, you're just the combination with Baba. And then you see the attitude of being an instrument. So Baba will do whatever Baba wants, and he may be getting something done through you that you don't even know about. Isn't it? That is service. So having that nimit attitude and humility is part of the removal of the ego, and words, sweet words, truthful words, not many words, you see. Because if we go back to that volcano, once you've exploded, once you've started, you know, the magma streams are streaming down your mountain. Again, we go to Japan for Mount Fuji, which is a very beautiful volcano. You have seen Mount Fuji, if not in pictures? Very simple. It's just a cone, bit of snow on top, a crater out of which comes the fire. That's it, you see, and there's nothing. I see. So when a volcano is exploding nicely, it's going way up into the top of the atmosphere and spreading out, you see. So what did Baba say? You know, we have to burn off everything so we can simply just go way up to the top and spread out these rays of these five original qualities. Because this is what people need. They don't need to listen to our lectures or our ego massaging productions that we do, isn't it? You know? We're not here to impress people. We can do that in the Iron Age, you know. But no, we're here to make ourselves to invoke Baba, that, okay, I'm your instrument, and the instrument has to be in good order. No clutter, no rust, no junk, just absolutely clean and pure, good instrument, and then let Baba do whatever he wants to do. The instrument must be ready and available at all times. And as you know, if Baba asks you to do something which is, of course, impossible, he always gives the power to do it. But we cannot take any credit for it. This is also something that becomes a mistake, you know. Baba does something, we take the credit, then all the actual benefit is lost because we ate the green fruit. So it's bitter, you know. The sweet fruit, you wait until it just comes by itself. And if you're very, you know, focused on your tyag and your tapasya and your volcanic stage, then every so often Baba will shower you with golden flowers of happiness, and it'll happen just all of a sudden. Have you experienced this? Yes. What is nicer than that, you know? So just keep on doing, keep on doing, keep on stoking up the fire, and keep on taking advantage of the precious few moments that we have, because we won't get another chance to do this for another 5,000 years, and that's a long wait. You see, and in between we'll be longing for it. And if while we have the chance we miss it, or we don't make it as a high priority, then it's a bit foolish. So in that sense, we actually have to be very self-centered, in the sense that the opportunity that Baba is giving for me to create my fortune and enjoy the company of great souls, excuse me, the beautiful souls of the Brahmin family. You know, just the fact that they are instrumental for my higher temperature doesn't detract from the fact that they are the greatest souls, isn't it? So we need to have a good power of interpretation, so that whatever is the stuff that comes our way that looks, you know, nasty and black and coal is actually fuel for my yoga, and I need to recognize that that's what it is and apply it to the fire, so that my volcano is flowing nicely and my temperature is up and I am melting and transforming and just enjoy that. We cannot afford to be afraid of those things. We enjoy those things. Like if you are a professional athlete, you go into whatever the sport is, you know, you don't get afraid of getting knocked down or fall over or any of that, because that's a loser right there. So one has to be very much skilled and keep on making oneself skillful. And all of the things that come, that present themselves as adversaries or adversities, interpret them to your advantage and use them for your further movement forward. Is it okay? Now, I've noticed a few people had a few thoughts that they wanted to share, so can we have another microphone for some questions? Is that okay? So you can come up and speak your question so that everybody can hear, because we're well scattered across this hall. I know you have a question.
Om Shanti. It's in context with the, when you said when we listen to Baba's Murli, there should be minimum distraction and we should be totally focused on the Murli. In that context, like this time of the day from 10:30 to 12:30, how can we be more alert and focused even on the classes, because we lose on very many important points even at this time, especially the yoga between 10:30 and 11, and then the class. And second aspect is, when we meet Avyakpaptada, the beginning period before Baba comes, you know, everybody is sitting to invoke Baba, but at that time I have noticed in just half an hour time, everybody is opening up their bags and there's fruit and there's biscuits and there's bread and chapatis and all. It was not there in the 80s. Because I remember in 80s when we used to come to meet Baba, the whole night we never used to have anything, the whole night. Even when Baba used to eat, we never used to eat. So I think there's a lot of distraction now.
Well, it's true, there is a lot of distraction. And I think one of the reasons is because the family is very big now. And there are a lot of people who, I mean, we can say there's greater number wiseness. Huh? There are people who are serious Rajyogis and there are other people who are not so serious Rajyogis. I think all of that, we cannot change it. We cannot do anything about it. We have to understand that it's it comes with size, you know. So it becomes necessary for us to intensify our own concentration and our own power of peace. Because from time to time, Baba has mentioned in these last few Muralis that is not your power of yoga, your power of peace, greater than their power of disturbance. Technically it should be. So if we have 22,000 people, of which 21,000 are disturbing us, am I in that 21,000 or am I in the 1,000 who have to be 21 times more powerful than the disturbing power of the 21,000 disturbers so that my peace can make them peaceful? This is a challenge, isn't it? And technically it's possible. But we just have to make a commitment to ourselves that, you know, it's not that if I can't beat 'em, join 'em. Yeah? It's not that if we think, yeah, please, not that if we think, oh, everybody's doing it, so what can I do? No. Individually, we make a commitment to ourselves that I will be with Baba in that quiet, in that stillness, and let me see how far the rays of my yoga can go. Technically, it's possible. So if each one of us makes that commitment, instead of thinking this is doing that and somebody's crackling and somebody's jumping up and down, and no, make my peace such. Yes. Now, can we put the mic up, the other question mic? Have you turned
I'll
it on?
I'll do
it. Ah, okay.
I have two questions for you. The first one is to define, you was mentioning in the beginning, will and determination.
Mm.
Could you define that, please?
Tell me the second question also.
And the second question is how to apply the defects, for example, you were mentioning to the fire.
Well, okay. So will and determination, this is the same thing really. Your will, your determination, huh? That's the same thing. You see, if you have your will, your ego-based will, your body-conscious will, or that kind of will, that's not going to be enough.
Sorry, I meant suppression.
Suppression, that's different.
The difference between suppression and
determination.
Oh,
that's
to define
a whole different question altogether. Suppression, yeah, okay, no problem. You have to have a very good power of discrimination, to discern within yourself if there is something going on and I'm pushing it down, I'm denying it, I'm forcing it, I'm applying pressure on it, but it's not going away. That's suppression. If I'm applying the fire of my determination, you know, in order to do that successfully, we have to not be antagonistic towards that particular vice. We have to be neutral. See, if I hate the vice, then I will try and destroy it with anger. You see, it won't work. But if I accept it, and I have a strong decision that, okay, you are there, whether it's lust, greed, anger, attachment, whatever the thing is, okay, it's there, I'm neutral, but we're not going to do this. You see? I don't care whether it's good or whether it's bad, but this is the rules and this is what we're going to do. So that's not suppression. There's neutrality, but your superior force is saying, okay, this is what we're going to do. Because after all, what is a vice? It's a distorted virtue. So if we are neutral about it, then we're not being negative towards the negative thing, you see. So, you know, if you want to put out fire with petrol, it's going to double. So you put out fire with water, you know it's fire. Okay, be cool. But you're not going to allow it, you see. It's different. Okay?
There you go. Just expand on that. As opposed to being neutral,
neutral,
you actually treat the vice as part of the soul and give it love instead, you know?
It's not giving it love or anything. Being neutral is being neutral. Being neutral is being unfazed by it, you know. I'm not dealing in pussycats and birthday cards, not at all, you know. So, okay, you can.
I have one more question real quick.
No, you have to give all the questions at once.
Yeah, okay. About manic depressive sanskars, I can relate to that since, anyway, I asked this question, how do you determine between, make the distinction between your own dictates and the dictates of the ego, meaning if you're going too high, for example, in terms of...
Well, that's still your own dictates.
Yeah.
So you want to distinguish between your own dictates and Srimad. Okay?
Okay.
Thanks. You had one more question I didn't take. What was that? How to apply the coal. Fear is a problem. Because when you're afraid of something, you don't like it, you have antagonism towards it, you want to make it go away, you want to take any kind of pill, whatever's necessary to stop it, whatever the thing is, you see. So fear has to be dealt with. You have to find your fearlessness. Fear is a big vice. So that means embracing the tiger. And the lion comes to eat you. One of the brothers had a heart attack while he was here a few weeks ago. And he was telling me that it was just like a lion coming to him to eat him completely. But just before it got to him, it stopped and kind of loped away. And we need to be in that mentality of fearlessness such that whatever the thing is that's coming, we are not scared by it. We are neutral about it. Okay, fine, let it come. I can deal with it. I can handle it. Even sometimes pain especially is something people are afraid of. That's why torture is so effective. You know, but we have to be able to allow pain to possess us, and then it will just go away. You see, resistance is our habit, but it increases the intensity of the thing that we don't like. So being neutral means, okay, let it be. whatever it is. I'm not disgusted by it, I'm not afraid of it, I'm not, you know, messed up by it. It is there. Huh? There's a nice little phrase that I use sometimes. It's not good, it's not bad, it just is. So you're not in denial of it. You know it is there, but you're not afraid of it. You're not saying, you're not assigning it a particular value. It's neutral, you know. It's a big elephant, okay, it's a big elephant. Fine, big elephant. So we deal with a big elephant. We can't say it's not a big elephant, it's a rhinoceros. No, it's a big elephant. It's not more than that, it's not less than that. And so if you have a big elephant in the way, then what do you have to do to deal with it? And then you go about your business and do it, you know, neutrally. I see. Because otherwise we have disgust, we have guilt, we have fear, we have denial, we have all of these negative emotions about negativity. And that's not useful, it's not productive for us. We have to be able to define it as what it is, without making it any bigger or any smaller than it actually is. Call a spade, however you want to call it, you know. And, okay, so be it. It is there. This is my challenge. I'll deal with it. You see? So neutral. Allow it to be what it is. You know, also be very neutral about other people's disgraceful behavior. That's very useful, you know. Ah, you want to behave like that? Fine, you have every right. Otherwise you get into all this long, long line of criticism. You can't do this and you can't do that. Why this and why that? No, okay, be like that. Fine, no problem. You have a perfect right, you know, and I'll get on with me, whoever I am, you see. It's okay. Once we start being against someone or against something, then we're applying negativity and it's not productive. But if we're neutral about it, then we can finish off those thoughts very quickly, because once you're neutral about something, what else is there to say about it? Just, it's not good, it's not bad, it just is. Okay, so we deal with it. If the floor is dirty, you wash it. Oh, the floor is dirty. You know. Why? No, you wash it. You've got a perfectly good bucket of water. You know. If there's garbage in the way, remove it. Put it in the dustbin. Who put this garbage? Why is this garbage here? It doesn't mean anything, you know, to do that. Because when we do that, we are actually going against our self-respect. We are forgetting that we are, you know, Rajyogis, we're supposed to be volcanoes, you know, so erupt nicely and spread beautiful vibrations of peace, love, purity, power and bliss. TK? Okay, Om Shanti.